Okay, so I'm going to give a bit of an introduction to the study theme for the weekend, revering and relying on the Dharma. So, recently many of us will have celebrated Parinirvana Day. 15th of February is the traditional day. And I guess many of you will have been celebrating that festival at your centres. And that those celebrations may have included readings from the Maha Parinibbana Sutta from the Pali Canon, which is a very moving and beautiful account of the last months of the Buddha's life. And there's a lovely scene in the middle of the sutta where the Buddha and Ananda, they've spent the rains together in a small village called Beluva. So the Buddha's now an old man of 80, and he's been very sick during the rains. He's come very close to death, but he felt it wasn't yet his time. He'd suppressed the illness, he comes through, and he starts to recover. And at a certain point, he's able to go out and sit in the sun, sit outside with Ananda. And Ananda just expresses his relief that the Buddha has recovered, that he hasn't yet died. But he adds that he comforted himself with the thought that the Buddha would surely not die without making some final statement to the order of monks. And the Buddha responds, "What does the order expect of me? Haven't I already given them enough?" And he goes on, "Ananda, I'm now old, worn out, venerable, one who's traversed life's path. Just as an old cart is made to go by being held together by straps, so the Tathagata's body is kept going by being strapped up." I really just really love that little remark of the Buddha. Worked on farms at one point, and just that image, of some old cart or bit of equipment, it's been mended so many times, it's beyond repair, just another little patch, another bit of rope, a bit of twine bale to hold it together, and it just keeps going a bit longer, but one day it's just going to collapse, and there's nothing to be done. You try and mend it properly, and it'll just fall apart. And the Buddha is just talking about his body as just being like this old farm cart, just strapped together. So soon the Buddha and Ananda are on their way again, walking the dusty roads of ancient India. And wherever they went, the monks, the lay followers, all the disciples would be gathered together, and the Buddha would urge, rouse and inspire them to sustain and deepen their efforts in the spiritual life. But I want to take us back now to the actual start of the sutta, some months earlier, where there's a fascinating incident. The Parinibbana Sutta actually begins in Magadha with Ajatasattu, one of the villains of the Pali Canon. And Ajatasattu is in his palace at Rajgaha, and he's plotting to attack the Vijayans, one of the neighbouring republics, as he's setting about expanding the Magadhan Empire. And he says to his minister, "I'll strike the Vijayans, who are so powerful and strong. I will cut them off and destroy them. I will bring them to destruction." But it's clear he's not completely confident in his boast, because he then sends his chief minister, Vasukara, to the Buddha, who's staying nearby on the Vulture's Peak. He says, "Go to the Buddha, tell him about my plans, and listen very carefully to what he says in response, for a Tathagata never lies." Interesting, isn't it? This villain of a king sending his minister to the Buddha just to tell him what his plans are and see what he says, just to sort of test the waters. So Vasukara goes to the Buddha, as Ajatasattu has told him, and he exchanges polite greetings with the Buddha, delivers his message, and rather than replying directly to Vasukara, the Buddha turns and he speaks to Ananda, and he says to him, as long honoured as the Vijayans hold regular and frequent assemblies, come together often in large numbers. They meet in harmony, do their business in harmony, part in harmony, and so on. He gives a whole list of conditions for their prosperity and strength. As long as they follow these conditions, they can be expected to prosper and not decline. And it becomes apparent that these are instructions that at some point earlier he'd actually given the Vijayans. And Vesakara is clearly impressed and he says, yes indeed, as long as the Vijayans do these things, they won't be overcome. Our only chance, he says, is to divide them and set them against each other. So of course, a lot of the listeners who heard these stories as they were passed on down would know very well that the Vijayans were indeed conquered by Ajatasattu and their territory annexed. So clearly they'd allowed themselves to be divided against each other. They'd forgotten the Buddha's injunctions. So Vesakara goes back to his king with his report. But it's obviously set the Buddha thinking, and he now sends out Ananda to gather all the monks in the neighbourhood together. And where they're assembled, he teaches them. And he sets out a whole set of conditions for the prosperity and welfare of the community that closely parallel, in many cases, the instructions to the Vijayans. You know, he begins with, as long as the brethren come together, often and in large numbers, the community can be expected to prosper and not decline. So we see the Buddha here, knowing he only had a limited time left, doing all he could to ensure the future health and strength and continuance of the spiritual community he'd founded. And in the last 18 months, couple of years, I've had a sense of something similar going on with Bhante, Urgyen Sangharakshita, and the Triratna Buddhist order and community that he's founded. So Bhante's 86 this year. His health isn't reliable. You know, it's clear he's determined to be around for as long as he can be. But it's also clear he's very conscious that he could die at any time. And he's concerned to do all that he can to ensure the future health and prosperity of the community he's founded. Do all he can to help make sure it remains as a living force for good in the world, as an effective vehicle for the Buddha Dharma. And it's also clear to me that his concern isn't just for the Triratna community, but for the establishment of Buddhism in the West. And, you know, he sees our community as having a very important part to play in establishing Buddhism as a vital living force in the world, in the West, in our modern world. So again and again he's going back to first principles, going back again and again to the essence of what Buddhism is, the essence of the Dharma, and really trying to make sure we've got it, we've got hold of it. So he's got out and about quite a bit in recent years, and he is still regularly meeting a lot of people at his home in Birmingham. And very significantly, along with that, he's brought out this series of papers, notably with the help of Subhuti, who's written up the conversations that he and other senior order members have been having with Bhante. So first of all, there was What is the Western Buddhist Order? This was before the name was changed, where Bhante spoke of the order as a community of his disciples and the disciples of his disciples and the disciples and so on and so on. And stressing the importance of our having a clear shared framework of teaching and practice. Then there was the conversation where Bhante spoke much more personally and informally about the early years of the order and the movement, particularly speaking about his own interest, his sexual activity, an area that has been problematic for some of his disciples. And doing this, I sense, with a view not to excuse or explain away or justify, but simply in order to allow us all at least more of a sympathetic understanding of the man that he is. So then came revering and relying on the Dharma, which we've been looking at over this weekend. And then most recently, reimagining the Buddha, which looks very much at the place of the imagination in the spiritual life. So the territory of this paper we're looking at this weekend, revering and relying on the Dharma, we could say is primarily one view or doctrine. So over the years, Bhante has said many things in many different ways, in many different situations, in books, in talks, seminars, question and answer sessions, using at times the terminology and perspectives of a wide range of Buddhist schools, as well as borrowing terms from Western philosophical, psychological, poetic and religious traditions. All this has been inspiring and illuminating, but inevitably there are apparent inconsistencies. And it's these apparent inconsistencies that, with Subhuti's help, Bhante is setting out to try and sort out and clarify in this paper. So they dealt in the conversations that Subhuti wrote up in this paper with a number of important topics that we can hopefully give a good look at in the study groups over this weekend. So a key area is the importance of views and the whole Buddhist understanding of what views are. So views aren't just arbitrary opinions that we just happen to hold, you know, that we happen to have picked up. Views rather reflect basic attitudes, assumptions. They reflect the fundamental patterning of our being. We assume views that match, if you like, the shape of our being. Subhuti, in his book, The Buddhist Vision, said very strikingly, we all have a view. You know, it's like we all have a particular view of the world, and that view of the world is shaped by our emotions and attitudes, assumptions, by the whole way we are, what we are. There is this distinction in the Buddhist tradition between right view, that is in accord with the way things are, and wrong view, which isn't. And there are the two fundamental wrong views of eternalism and nihilism. Again, I'm not going to go into them in detail now, but we can look at them in the study groups. So our views shape the way we live, the way we respond to life. And our views can either support or inhibit a movement towards love, freedom, wisdom, and away from greed, hatred, and delusion. So views very much matter. Now, views actually shape the way we live. Views shape the way we go about, live, understand the spiritual life. Views actually define whether or not we have an effective spiritual life. So views are important. So the first thing sort of setting down that we really want to have a good look at this weekend is the importance of views and the meaning of right view and wrong view. So Bhante then goes on to speak of the Buddha's metaphysical reticence. So this doesn't mean that the Buddha was very shy. What it means was that the Buddha avoided metaphysical abstraction and speculative views. The Buddha would say, I teach liberation. Liberation, that is, from all greed, hatred and delusion. I teach liberation and the path to liberation. And he'd tell people, forget speculative views. Forget, debating about this person's teachings and that person's teachings. Just follow my teachings, practice, make an effort. Allow the path to unfold in you and through you. And this attitude of pragmatism, of avoidance, of metaphysical speculation is captured in the in lines from the Pabeda Sutta that we'll be hearing more of this weekend, of the Sutta Nipata, one of the very early Buddhist scriptures, where the man of calm is described. And he's described as one who has no concern with how things began or with how they will end, and no fixation with what happens in between. And a bit later, it is a man who does not enter into speculation, a man free from speculation. So, what the Buddha does, his concern is to address the question of transforming ourselves. And that's his abiding, enduring concern. He's not interested in debating with people, you know, who believe in God or don't believe in God, or what happens or what doesn't happen when a Buddha dies. He's just not interested in going down these avenues which just lead to endless speculation. He's just interested in the work of transformation. So there's this whole question then of how we can have confidence in a goal and in forces beyond this limited selfhood. Have confidence in a goal and forces that give shape and direction to our Dharma life, without suggesting something metaphysical that truly exists. So, yeah, there is this concern, you know, how to have a spiritual life, a sense of something more, something beyond our present way of being, but not actually come up with a thing, you know, a God or a whatever, something that's sort of directing it all or shaping it all. So we want to look at this metaphysical reticence of the Buddhas and how he deals with the spiritual life in this very pragmatic way and avoids speculation, which, you know, it's very difficult for us not to but it's so difficult just to practice, just to apply ourselves to the teachings and just do that and not have all these questions that we want answered. So moving on, for Sangharakshita, as for the Buddha, the fundamental expression of right view is praticca samuppada, or conditioned co-production. And this teaching, praticca samuppada, involves a simple observation of how things arise and pass. Involves observation of the order and regularity in the processes of existence. And then, with this, a deepening understanding of how we can work with the patternings, the regularities in the process of existence. So one of the classic statements of this principle of praticca samuppada is this being, that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. So it sounds deceptively simple, doesn't it? This being, that becomes. You know, obvious. We don't need a Buddha to tell us that, do we? But how far, you know, how far have we really understood this teaching? If we really understood it, we'd be at least a stream entrant. Again, there's one of these lovely little incidents in the Pali Canon where poor old Ananda puts his foot in it yet again. So the Buddha is staying amongst the Kurus at Kamasadhamma, a suburb of the Kurus, and Ananda goes to the Buddha, salutes him, sits down at one side, and he says, "It's wonderful, Lord, it's marvellous, Lord. How deep is this causal law? How deep it seems. And yet I do regard it as quite plain to understand." And the Buddha responds, "Say not so, Ananda, say not so. Deep indeed is this causal law, and deep it appears to be. It is by not knowing, by not understanding, by not penetrating this doctrine, that this world of men has become entangled like a ball of twine, become covered with mildew, become like munja grass and rushes, unable to pass beyond the doom of the waste, the way of woe, the fall, and the ceaseless round of rebirth." So the Buddha makes it very clear to Ananda that it may seem simple, but actually there's something very profound, very mysterious in this teaching of Pratityasamutpada. So again, let's really try to clarify our understanding as far as we can, really begin to get a sense, you know, both a clear conceptual understanding, but also something of the profundity and mystery that Pratityasamutpada points towards. So in this paper, Bhante unpacks the understanding of Pratityasamutpada in terms of the five niyamas. So this is a teaching found in Buddha Ghosha's Visuddhimagga, but here Bhante actually unfolds the teaching in a way that he hasn't even done previously in his own exposition of the Dharma. We could say in a way that's actually very much consistent with the teaching of the Buddha in the suttas, but sufficiently different from previous usage in the tradition to be seen as actually quite a new development. So this is actually Bhante using a traditional teaching, presenting it, opening it up in a way to give us a new hold on our understanding of Pratityasamutpada. So I'm just going to give a very brief overview now of the five niyamas, these five levels or orders of conditionality. So first of all is Utta niyama, physical inorganic matter. You could say the subject matter of physics and chemistry. So it's seeing the patterns, the regularities at that level of conditionality. Then there's Bija niyama, the conditioned relationships within living organisms, with the field of botany, biology, physiology, and so on. And then Mano niyama, the conditioned relationships, the processes within the animal kingdom, within all those organisms that have sensory perception. And these niyamas, they're not like parallel railway lines, they're not completely separate, but actually all very much interwoven, all operating together, having an effect on each other, and all operating within each of us, as well as in the world around us. So then karma niyama, the order of conditionality that comes into play with the emergence of a self-reflexive consciousness. You could say as consciousness unfolds and self-reflexive consciousness emerges, so karma niyama, this other order of conditionality comes into play. And this is the arena of ethics. So ethics in the Buddhist tradition is seen, again, as something quite natural. It's to do with understanding this natural patterning and processes in existence. So we can act in accord with the way things are. And this involves acting, we could say, ethically. It involves understanding that certain actions, which the tradition calls skillful, lead to greater freedom, happiness for oneself and others, whilst other actions, which actions of body, speech and mind, which the tradition terms unskillful, they lead to limitation and to unnecessary suffering. So karma niyama. And then finally dhamma niyama. So in his presentation of the niyamas, Sangharakshita sees the dhamma niyama as comprising all those conditioned processes by means of which a Buddha arises. So Buddhahood isn't seen, understood in the Buddhist tradition as a random event, nor is it given and inevitable. Buddhahood arises, is gained by establishing a whole sequence of conditions, each of which arises out of the preceding, in accordance with Praticca Samuppada. This being, that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. So we need to actually understand and work with these regularities, with these patterns inherent in reality. And the capacity, the potential for greater joy, happiness, following karma niyama, and eventually for enlightenment itself by harmonizing with dharma niyama. All this is part of the way things are. So we can actually see through these five niyamas a progressive trend within reality. It is as if life, as if the universe is constantly seeking to go beyond itself. So we have this apparently blind emergence of ever more complex forms of life, all the way up to beings with a self-reflexive consciousness. And then karma niyama comes into play with the possibility of choice, of further unfoldment, or of, if we don't see and understand karma niyama clearly, becoming sidetracked, even of degenerating. And if this progressive trend within existence is maintained along the path discovered and taught by the Buddha, then consciousness, or a consciousness, can unfold that is less and less self-referential, more and more attuned to the way things really are. So a new process comes into play, dharma niyama, with the arising of knowledge and vision of things as they really are, with its own inner dynamic of pure progression towards enlightenment. So a different sort of consciousness is now in play. It's spoken of in the Mahayana tradition as the bodhicitta, which involves being experienced as a will beyond one's own will, which we can choose to align ourselves with more and more, rather than needing to make an effort of self-will. So Praticca Samuppada, the working of which is further described in this scheme of niyamas, we could say it's simply a description of processes at play in the universe and the possibility of aligning ourselves, of working to align ourselves with them. So we don't have to worry about explanations. We don't have to worry why it's like this. We simply have to engage in the work, the process of transformation. Test it out, find what works, and just get on with it. So I'm not planning in this talk to go into the whole discussion of evolution, higher and lower, that is covered in the paper. You can discuss that again in the groups if you wish to, if you've got time. But here I'm just wanting to try and bring out the most important points. So the recognition of this progressive trend within Praticca Samuppada is essential to the leading of the Dharma life. We need to have that trust, confidence in the possibility of going beyond our present level of consciousness, going beyond our present way of being, and seeing that this is only going to happen if we create the conditions out of which those higher possibilities can emerge. So we need to be convinced in karma niyama. We need to be convinced in the law of karma, that actions have consequences, that the Buddhist teachings on sila, ethics, really do set out the conditions for the arising of more wholesome, skillful states, and make it possible for dharma niyama to come into play. We need to have faith, trust, confidence in dharma niyama. Faith that in overcoming this illusion of a fixed self, the clinging and craving, holding on to this fixed self, that rather through living unselfishly, practicing meditation, studying the Dharma, devotional practice, generosity, all the traditional practices, that all of this will help us cut through the illusion of selfhood. And in letting go more and more, giving up more and more of the old habits and securities that we've built around the idea of a fixed self, that in that letting go we will indeed enter into a richer, more creative, freer, happier, more joyful mode of being, and not just disappear down a great black hole. So we really do need to trust in the process. We really do need to learn to trust more and more in the path and the process, and feel able to let go more and more deeply, more and more fully. We could say that in the end it comes down to faith and trust and confidence in the Buddha, in Shraddha that relies on the Buddha, faith and trust that a human being actually entered into the truth, the reality of things, went beyond the humanity that we're familiar with, entered into a new mode of being that is fully in accord, fully aligned with the way things are. Strange, wonderful, beautiful, mysterious. The fulfillment of our deepest potential and nature. And we need to have trust and confidence that this possibility is open to all of us if we take note of the Buddha's teachings. Take fully to heart and practice wholeheartedly, consistently, determinedly, that we too can know the wisdom and compassion of the Buddhas. So I've not covered everything in the paper, Revering and Relying on the Dharma, but I hope I've at least touched on most of the key points. So I just want to finish with a brief reminder of some of those main areas that we may want to discuss in our groups over the next couple of days. So I began by saying how Bente Urgyen Sangharakshita, he's an old man now, and he's really seeking to ensure the future of the order, the movement he's founded. And more than that, make sure that the foundations are strong and clear in the essentials of the Dharma, so that the order, the movement, Buddhism and the West can grow and expand and flourish and make a really significant contribution to the world. And this is the perspective, I think, in which we need to look at and understand this paper. Then the importance of views, of right view, wrong view, eternalism, nihilism. And we might even look at how even right view needs to be held, not too tightly and dogmatically, not too lightly and superficially. So there's a lot to explore there in the importance of views and what right view and wrong view mean, eternalism, nihilism and so on. Then the Buddha's metaphysical reticence, his pragmatism, the very practical nature of his teachings. Why the Buddha avoided metaphysical speculation, even if later Buddhists just couldn't help themselves and did go down that road. Why the Buddha, throughout his teaching career, just refused to get caught up in metaphysical speculation. We can look at Pratichasamutpada, ask ourselves how clearly and deeply we understand it. And we can look at the five niyamas, and in particular at the significance of karma niyama and dharma niyama. And finally, we can look at the importance of the Buddha, the historical Buddha, as a focus of faith, trust and confidence in the teaching and the path and the whole process of the spiritual life. So I think we have in this paper from Bhante, written up by Subhuti, a very valuable and important gift. There's so much in it to consider and reflect on. And I think it's going to be the source of fruitful exploration for us for many years to come. But let's make good use of this weekend to really start to dig in and get to grips with it. Thank you.